Please all rise. Hear ye, hear ye. This Honorable Appellate Court for the 2nd Judicial District is now in session. Honorable Christopher M. Kennedy presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Please be seated.
The first case on the docket this morning is 2-5-0023, American Backflow & Fire Incorporated against Dan Harbeck, plaintiff's appellant, C. William J. McHink, Sprinkler Fitters & Premises, Union Local 281, U.A., Jennifer McDonald, J.O. J. Lecker, Frank Walsick, and William P. Callanan, and also Jensen and Paul Kyle C., defendant's appellant. Arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. George W. Spoto. Arguing on behalf of the appellee, William Callanan, Mr. Marcus Ryder. Arguing on behalf of the appellee, Jennifer McDonald, Mr. Andrew S. Pidgeon.
All right, Mr. Svoboda, you may begin when ready. And I understand counsel for appellees were splitting their time 9 and 6 minutes, correct?
Yes, sir. Okay.
All right, please proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, I'm George W. Svoboda. I'm representing the appellants in this case, American Backflow and Fire Prevention, and Dan Harbutt. This is a case where a union and its representatives were trying to put American Backflow out of business. American Backflow is a non-union contractor in the fire sprinkler industry. Dan Harbutt is the president of American Backflow, is known to the unions. We pled in our complaint, defamation, two counts of defamation, two counts of tortious interference, and violation of the trade libel or the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and conspiracy. This case is at the pleading stage. We're appealing from a situation where the trial court dismissed our complaint with prejudice, and the primary issues was...
This is 2619A9?
It was a 2-619A9A, or...
Like an affirmative defense, basically.
Yeah, as an affirmative defense. The primary issue that the trial court relied on was the absolute litigation privilege. Mm-hmm. There were two other ancillary issues that are in the briefs. One is whether this is preempted under the National Labor Relations Act, and the other would be whether the defamation was outside the statute of limitations. Those were not decided by the trial court, but I'll address them briefly. Any other issues that were brought up in the briefs and the motions to dismiss were 2-615 issues, and if the court believes that our pleadings were deficient, we'd ask that the case be remanded for us to correct those issues. The primary issue is the absolute litigation privilege. And what
now
happened...
Illinois has a privilege as well as the restatement. Illinois' privilege is broader than the restatement, isn't it?
That's correct, yes. And I think we cited several cases that lay out the privilege. I think Robbie versus the School of Art Institute of Chicago kind of set out the nature of the privilege. Defend versus Lascelles set out some interest in the societal importance of the privilege. Scarpelli versus McDermott, Will, and Emery talked about the purpose of the privilege. And then some of the other cases in Illinois actually get into the details of, when the privilege applies. such as...
So the whole crux here, the thing that I am seeing, and it seems to be what the trial court was looking at as well as you gentlemen, is whether or not these statements were made in this case, quasi-judicial proceedings, in order to determine whether the privilege does in fact apply. How were these not quasi-judicial proceedings, counsel?
And I think that's a very important part. I do want to also touch on the fact that they also need to be parties to be protected.
Do they?
Or a witness who is being called as part of a proceeding. So let me first talk about quasi-judicial bodies, right? For it to be a quasi-judicial proceeding, we talk about whether NICET and ASSE are quasi-judicial bodies. I should briefly touch on, these were complaints that were made to these bodies who issue certifications in the profession. The complaints were unsolicited. And it's not the complaints themselves, but it was the defamation that occurred in the complaints where Mr. Hinks, who represents the union as an officer, said that American Backflow has a history of committing fraudulent activities. And Dan Harbutt has limited experience in the industry, which is his core business. So that's the defamation that we're speaking about. That was made by sending letters to NICET and ASSE.
Does the litigation privilege include, doesn't it include communications like before, during, and after? Doesn't have to be only during a quasi-judicial proceeding.
By a party in anticipation of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And we should...
What was the status of the union litigation at this point?
There was an NLRB case, mm-hmm, where the union had claimed some unfair labor practices.
And where was that pending? Was that pending at the time? Was it before or was it
after?
Yes,
those cases were open and pending.
Okay.
The unfair labor practices were unresolved. And yes, in the union. But in the Lynn case, which we cited, Lynn versus United Plant Guard Workers of America, Local 114.
Mm-hmm.
That's a U.S. Supreme Court case. That sets out when a case is preempted by the NLRA. And it's pretty clear in here that if there's defamation that's malicious, and in this case we alleged it was malicious, they were trying to put American Backflow out of business, and we supported that with an affidavit. If it's malicious and intentional, it's not really part of the NLRA anymore. In fact, Lynn says it's not, and the state court has rights. The state of Illinois has rights to defend its citizens against the defamation. And so then we get back to, is this a litigation proceeding? There was no litigation between American Backflow and ASSE or NICET at this time that the appellees were inserting themselves into. They were initiating something that they would not be a party to. And if you look at, I believe...
Let me ask you this. How about analogize this as some of the cases, and I think you cited some of the cases, that you have the ARDC where somebody makes a complaint and they might not be a party to the litigation, but they make a complaint. How is this not the same? Because when you look at NICET and AASC, eventually this would go to the fire marshal, correct?
No. Those bodies, this was a specific complaint against the certification.
Certification.
Right.
But in the end, if you're not certified, I mean...
If you're not certified, but there are three certification bodies and apprenticeship schools that you can also qualify through. So the Act, and the Act is 225 ILCS 317-17B13, the Fire Sprinkler Act.
Right.
It mentions ASSC and NYSED as mm-hmm. places where you can get a certification or prove you have experience. It also mentions these apprenticeship programs. It does not delegate them authority. It just says you need to get a certification from one of these three schools or programs or an apprenticeship program.
So your clients sent their individuals to Pennsylvania?
That's right, for ASSC.
ASSC in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Okay.
And they were awarded certifications there. But ASSC was not delegated any authority. So we get into the six powers of are these quasi-judicial bodies or not. The six powers are found in Zeit versus Tucker. They're also in Bellumini versus Zarczynski. But if we get back to the ARDC, who... You think about the six powers, they actually have a delegation of authority from the U.S. or the Illinois Supreme Court to regulate the attorney profession on behalf of the court. And that delegation of power really is more covered under Richardson versus Dunbar. But it's very clear in that case they're a quasi-judicial body. The American Arbitration Association is one where they're actually a private company similar to NYSED and ASSC, but they're actually standing in the place of the court, and they have all of the powers of a court in litigation proceedings. ASSC and NYSED have none of those things independent of just regulating their own little business. And even then, they don't have any power to subpoena. They don't have any power to have witnesses. In the case of ASSC, they didn't even have a hearing. They didn't call witnesses. The appellees were never called in to testify. There was nothing ever really opened in terms of a litigation between them. They sent a request for information to American Backflow as, you know, and its employees as a certificate holder.
Well, do you need to have all six of the powers in order to determine whether or not it's a quasi-judicial branch?
No, and that's where it becomes extraordinarily muddy in Illinois about whether something's a quasi-judicial body or not.
I think I read a case, was it like the ALIG, where they said it was not?
Yes, so that's Zeit versus Tucker. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the Office of Internal Affairs of the Cook County Sheriff's Department was not a quasi-judicial body. They run investigations similar to ASSC and NYSED, but they didn't have enough of what really makes quasi-judicial bodies. I was trying to think, like, where are there examples that are similar to this, where it's not the American Arbitration Association or the ARDC, where it's a bright line, they're a quasi-judicial body. If you Google search it, it says, generally, it's arbitration. It's meant to cover arbitration companies or administrative agencies.
The way I read it, it's something beyond a mere investigation.
Right.
You know, it has to have some teeth after the investigation. And so in this case, when you would be suspending or somebody would be suspending or taking away a power like the ability to do these fire sprinkler, what am I trying to say?
Certifications
or sprinkler business. Mm-hmm. That gives it a little more teeth than just a mere investigation, doesn't it?
So they can take away the certification, but they can't prevent them from acting within the industry. Because then you can go to one of the other boards and get a certification from there.
Okay.
Or you can complete an apprenticeship program. So they don't really regulate the profession at all. They say, did you have the experience? Did you pass the test? And they can take away their certification just like a homeowner's association might be able to say that you have to take a fence down. You know, and, but it really gets to what's judicial. Are you acting in a judicial capacity? Are you really have all the powers to stop, you know, to, you know, really affect somebody's rights? And in this case, they don't. They couldn't stop them from acting in the profession at all.
But if they, if it went further, I mean, let's talk about the General Assembly in this case when they enforced this act. They talked about public policy. And how is public policy not served here in this case?
So that's a good point. And we did bring up public policy. I believe that's covered in... I don't have it immediately in front of me, but it becomes whether the... when you're talking about somebody independently reporting to maybe an act that they believe is illegal, such as to the sheriff, it's a qualified privilege. So you, in a qualified privilege, and one of the cases covers it, and I can't find it immediately in front of me, but in a qualified privilege, there is an exception to qualified privilege that says that you cannot be doing it with malice and you must be truthful. And in our pleadings, we said, look, this was done with malice. This was not to serve the public good. This was not truthful.
Couldn't you argue that it was used to serve the public good to prevent somebody from going out there who wasn't certified? Like the son.
They can argue that, but now we're into a question of fact that really should be decided at trial before it's before you. It shouldn't be, you know, decided on pleadings and a motion to dismiss.
I'm sorry, I've questioned you so much that you probably didn't get to get to areas that you wanted to get to.
No, that's good. So I think I've got to check off what we've covered. Am I over my time? I didn't hear the thing.
Can conclude. I think we have at least one more question for you, and you'll have time on rebuttal as well.
This relates to certification, does it not?
It does.
There are certain aspects of, I think, any communication that is considered libelous or slanderous, like commission of a crime. Would that be correct?
Yes.
So when the defendants say something like, you're a fraudster or you've committed fraud, is that a crime? Or is it a civil wrong? And if it's a civil wrong, is it distinguishable? Or is it sufficiently similar that the privilege doesn't apply?
At that point, it's a qualified privilege, and so it gets to the point of whether you can't go and allege that somebody committed murder and they didn't commit murder and it was just a lie. You know, so if you prove that American Backflow was a fraudster and that you prove that Dan Harbutt, but that really gets to the basis of defamation in general, is you have the state, if the statements are true, it's a defense. But we're not anywhere at that stage at this point in the pleadings of this case.
So what were the fighting words that you think would entitle you to recovery?
That American Backflow was a fraudster, that committed fraudulent acts, and that Dan Harbutt was not qualified to do his job in the fire sprinkler industry.
Is that issue subsumed into whether or not he's entitled to certification? Put another way, if he is going to be certified or not certified is dependent on whether or not he's a fraudster, would that then be pivotal, linchpin? And would it be or would it not be privileged under those circumstances?
It's relevant, but it wouldn't be privileged.
I have no further questions.
All right, thank you, counsel. You'll have time on a rebuttal. And Mr. Riley, are you first?
May it please the Court, Marcos Riley for all defendants' appellees except Jennifer McDonald, who has her own attorney that we'll be hearing from as well. With regard to preemption under federal law, I think that the appellant is blurring the standard a little bit. The federal courts have held that malice takes a state court claim out of federal preemption, but malice is a term of art. They have specifically adopted the definition of malice in the New York Times versus Sullivan case, which is a First Amendment case addressing whether a criticism of a public official is defamatory or if it's protected. So the labor law has adopted the First Amendment standard. That is not a subjective standard. It doesn't have to do with the state of mind of the person making the statement. It merely means that the statement is false and that it has been made with knowledge of the falsehood or with reckless disregard of its falsity. So when we're talking about the allegations in the complaint that representatives of the defendants allegedly said they wanted to put a plaintiff out of business, that goes outside of the scope of the definition of malice. It's really irrelevant. I would also argue it's not really a well-pleaded fact if you look at the pleading, but the court can read the pleading. Somebody said this, basically, and then there's an affidavit that's very, very unspecific about when it was supposedly overheard and who said it. But in any event, it's irrelevant to the federal preemption argument.
Let's go back, because this is something that I think is at the crux of this case, is the plaintiff says, the appellant says, that NYSET and ASSE are private entities. Thus, they're not quasi-judicial. Are they private entities?
Well, unquestionably, they are private entities. But I believe under the statute, they are exercising delegated authority. They're not exclusive. You can get certification other ways, but they are specifically mentioned in the statute as a way that you can be certified. So it's kind of a hybrid situation. They're private entities serving a public purpose.
Is the communication that they were having that counsel tenders is libel or slander, the basis of this, like this litigation, is it really proposed to pending litigation? I mean, you don't really have, you do have a private entity. They could be treated differently, but the statements that were made, were they really regarding pending legislation? How can you argue that?
Well, Your Honor, we would argue that this is a quasi-judicial body exercising a quasi-judicial function, and the function is to investigate and adjudicate complaints from interested parties, and the rules of both of these parties are in the record, and they provide for that. So these allegedly defamatory comments or statements were effectively complaints to be adjudicated by these bodies, and they were adjudicated not in the same way, with the same level of formality as a court, but with a process that's defined, and we would submit that that qualifies as a quasi-judicial process.
So after they investigate and adjudicate, then what happens?
In this case, they pretty much agreed with the complaints, and they either canceled or modified, curtailed the privileges that had been accorded by those bodies. And we believe that gives them sufficient coercive power, if you want to put it that way. They can't subpoena, but if you're certified by them, if you don't cooperate with the investigation, you won't be certified. So that's fairly...
How about, is there ever a hearing panel in place in these types of cases?
Well, in this situation, on this record, they convened a committee and they had a meeting. You could call it a hearing. It's quasi-judicial. It wasn't, I don't think, styled specifically as a hearing. But they heard from the affected parties and they made a decision.
Do they have the power to compel attendance of witnesses and examine witnesses?
other than the power inherent in people being members of those organizations and being certified by those organizations and therefore subject to the organization's power, no, they can't issue subpoenas. But they can hear testimony. They can take documentary evidence as well. And they did.
And is there a process? So they convened a committee that did what? That it heard evidence?
They considered
in what form?
Sorry. It was in written form. They considered the written submissions from the complainants. They considered the submissions of the people certified, the representatives of the plaintiff appellant, and they made a decision.
Well, Local 281 intended to persuade the fire marshal to seek injunctive relief.
That's another, right? Yes, that's a separate basis for the litigation privilege. There are really three. There is the NYSED ASSE one. There's the National Labor Relations Board because there were 17 unfair labor practice proceedings pending. And then there was the intention by Local 281 to either have the fire marshal pursuant to statutory authority pursue injunctive action to stop the plaintiff from proceeding without a proper license, or if the
but that wasn't necessary.
It proved to be unnecessary, but they were contemplating that, as is attested to by Mr. Hinks in his affidavit, and it's unrebutted. This is a 2619
motion. The appellant has argued that that would be it'd be a qualified privilege. What's your counter-argument to that?
Well, I think the case law says that the litigation privilege is absolute, regardless of whether it is anticipated litigation or actual litigation. And it extends to parties and attorneys and can extend to witnesses as well.
What would the litigation be on behalf of the fire marshal?
It would have been an action in the circuit court to enjoin American Backflow from proceeding using unqualified or uncertified fire sprinkler employees. And again, this is unrebutted. It's attested to that this was the plan by Mr. Hinks, and they didn't submit a counter affidavit. So it stands. It's not addressed in the complaint, of course, one way or the other. We think it's clear that the National Labor Relations Board is a quasi-judicial body. And as we pointed out, they say so on their own website. Have many of the attributes of the court. Under the preemption law, there's a large body of law stating they're the expert on unfair labor practices. They have exclusive jurisdiction. They hear testimony. They make decisions. They have the power of subpoena. There were 17 separate unfair labor practice actions going on at this time.
Were the unfair labor practices complaints still pending before the NLRB at the time of the statements alleged as defamatory?
Some of them were, Your Honor. There's a lot of them that overlap. But yes, there were ongoing proceedings relating to this at the time. And relating directly to American Backflow's firing qualified people in retaliation and as it was found wrongfully under federal labor law and putting the people that they tried to qualify into the bargaining group to dilute the vote so that they wouldn't vote for the union. And these are issues that were addressed directly by the NLRB. So we believe that the pertinent standard is broad under Illinois law, and we believe that these statements are pertinent to the issues that were pending before the NLRB.
Their argument, too, is that the individuals making the statements were not parties to that litigation. What's your counter on that?
Well, when you have a quasi-judicial body, you don't have the level of formality that you'd have in a court, so it's maybe a little difficult to determine who's a party, but if you're the one making the complaint, I think it's common sense that you're a party. All of the individuals who were sued were complainants, and they acted for the union.
Are the motives of those statements, are those relevant or not relevant in this?
I don't think they're relevant under the case law of the absolute privilege. You can say it for whatever reason you want to if it's pertinent.
All right. Thank you. We have no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Pigott. You may proceed when ready.
Uh, Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel. If it please the court, ASSC, NICET, and the fire marshal were quasi-judicial bodies, and the fact that they are private, that with the exception of the fire marshal, that they are private entities, does not matter. Multiple varieties of private adjudicators and accreditors have been found to be quasi-judicial. In Bushnell v. Caterpillar, this court specifically rejected its appellant's claim that, quote, private arbitration proceedings do not constitute quasi-judicial proceedings, responding, the exercise of the judicial function is not confined to tribunals created by legislative provisions. A complaint to the Illinois Council of Optometric Education was held privileged in Illinois College of Optometry versus La Bombarda. The National Association of Security Dealers was assumed or found to be quasi-judicial, respectively, in Bavarotti versus Joseph Thal, Lyon and Ross, and Dunn versus Langberg, Thalman and Company. And even a church tribunal was held to be a quasi-judicial body in McClay versus Beckman. The question is, does the body have the requisite powers? And there are six factors, and it must be stressed that these are factors because appellants attempt to make them elements when they are not. There are only two of the six factors that appellants contest. The ability to compel the appearance of witnesses, which is only one part of that, I believe it's the fifth factor, and the contention that ASSC and NICET cannot impose penalties, even though they can strip licenses that are necessary for ABFP's employees to legally perform fire sprinkler safety work in Illinois.
And his response, counsel's response to that, well, they can always move on and get certified by somebody else. Doesn't have to be through either one of them. So the fact that they can enforce penalties or impose penalties, they're not permanent penalties, are they?
Well, Your Honor, I'd respond to that in two ways. First, and I apologize if my memory fails me, but I don't believe I've heard that argument before, meaning that it is presently waived.
Oh, you heard it today for the first time? Is that what you're saying?
I believe so, Your Honor. Second, you know, there is still the lag in time between the stripping of the certifications they sought and their obtaining of an additional certification. I would say it's speculative that they can actually, you know, who knows whether they can. You know, they failed to demonstrate adequate work experience to maintain their licenses through ASSC and NICET. Who's to say that that won't happen with their next application? So again, returning to the fact that these are merely factors and not elements, I would point out that the ARDC was found to be a quasi-judicial body despite only having five of the six, in particular, not having the power to enforce its own judgments or impose penalties. And the Illinois College of in La Bombarda, the Council on Optometric Education, was found to be quasi-judicial, even though it apparently had no subpoena power of its own. And respecting subpoena power, I find the appellant's reliance on that problematic, considering that the information that was at issue in its proceedings before ASSC and NICET was within its own control. What are your and your employees' work experience? There's never been any suggestion as to who appellants would actually have needed to subpoena. And finally, to respond to one of plaintiff's other arguments, contending that the hearing procedures were somehow so inadequate through ASSC and NICET that they could not be considered quasi-judicial.
I'd like to point out, and we actually set out their procedures on pages 8 and 9 of our brief. NYSIT, after accepting the complaint, convenes a hearing panel, quote, to review the complainant's statements and, if necessary, formally solicit answers to specific questions of the applicant or certificant. The hearing panel's ruling will then be conveyed in writing to the applicant or certificant and the complainant. If dissatisfied with the hearing panel's initial ruling, a certificant may request an audio-recorded formal hearing where the certificant will receive, quote, a clear statement of the allegations to be heard, where the certificant, quote, will have the right to have legal counsel present and to call witnesses, or, quote, to submit written testimony in lieu of appearing at the formal hearing. And then there's even an appeals process provided on top of that. Similarly, ASSE, as noted, offered, sent a formal request. I'm sorry, I see I've reached my time, Your Honor. If I may briefly conclude just by saying that after a building is burned down, possibly with people in it, that's a bad time to find out that the person who designed or installed the fire sprinkler safety system was unqualified. And the only way the situation could be worse is if someone who knew about the lack of qualification remained silent for fear of a defamation suit. Ms. McDonald asks that you affirm the judgment of the court below to avoid such tragedies. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Mr. Svoboda, you may argue in rebuttal.
I do want to address whether we waived the argument of can the appellants go to another organization. And I believe in our appellate brief on page 18, we talked about the Act and the various certification organizations and that all that.
The lack of finality. Right. Let me ask you a quick question. We talked a little bit about public policy earlier, but doesn't another issue or another facet of public policy is if somebody can be sued for defamation or tortious interference or violation of a trade act or conspiracy, whatever it is that you charged in this case, if they can be charged with that, wouldn't that discourage individuals from reporting what otherwise might be behavior that could be harmful, as we talked about, to the general public? Because I think here, and I think I mentioned earlier, I don't think the statements have to be, I think you kept saying, oh, these statements are vicious, or how can people know when they can't make a report on something like this?
Well, we get to the qualified privilege, and the qualified privilege says that the statements have to be true. They can't be false, knowingly false. It says they can't be made with malice, which, is kind of an open definition.
Yes, that's the word.
But I think if you stick to the facts and you say, I saw this person do this and these are the facts, and you don't make broad categorizations about the person claiming that they're unfit person.
If the son is 17 and he gets certification and one of the mandates for certification is like 5 years experience,
we didn't complain that that was defamation. And Caden Harbutt is not a party. We didn't say that they couldn't make a complaint about Caden Harbutt and Lindsay Bouffard, even though I think there's something that talks about the other case that we had, which will also be before you eventually, but ASSE, Caden Harbutt, Lindsay Bouffard, and David Less sued ASSE for breach of contract. So they have recourse under breach of contract. Again, not under an appeal of the decision, but to say, we had a contract and that's that's why this isn't really quasi-judicial. It's two parties who are contracting for these certifications. So, again, ASSE never held a hearing. They didn't have any judicial process that they followed. I did hear counsel speak about NYSED having a process, and they do have a process. However, the statements made about American Backflow and Dan Harbutt were not part of that process with NYSED. Dan Harbutt didn't even have a NYSED certification, never applied for that.
But does that matter? What they say, I mean, is that relevant?
It does because it's a qualified privilege is what we're
saying. You're
saying
it's relevant because of, okay, qualified, not absolute.
Right. Because they're witnesses, they weren't called to come and present. They're just witnesses coming and saying that they saw something. They're reporting something, just similar to a good citizen going to the police department. And when we talk about Hinks and his affidavit, we did not offer an affidavit in response to that because we thought it, one, it's very narrow. It's supposed to be on the affirmative matter, right? So it's not, you can't go and refute what we pled in our complaint in that affidavit. So there wasn't any reason from that perspective. Also, on the affirmative matter, what he said was, oh, I was going to act as a private attorney general. Well, there's no, Illinois doesn't have private attorney generals. There's no, it's not, Illinois specifically says in the case law that there's no private attorney generals. And his reporting to the fire marshal, again, would be as a good Samaritan to the fire marshal. So my time is up.
You may conclude if you have anything to add.
I have a question or two. There are sanctions or sanctionable aspects of pleadings, and they're usually called vexatious or false pleadings. Or it can be so bad as to be independently actionable as defamation. Where does your cause of action fall? Vexatious false pleadings? Perjury?
For the complaints against Harbutt and American Backflow?
I'm trying to relate to a frame of reference that I can benchmark mm-hmm. what your argument is with things that are much more familiar to me.
Right.
And so I'm looking for an analogy or a comparison.
Well,
think is persuasive.
So this wasn't sworn testimony. So, I mean, they sent letters. So I don't think that would fall under that standard of, you know, sanctionable or vexatious. But I do believe it was published in those letters and under the defamation standard, and it was untrue, and it was malicious with an intent to do harm, you know, that did actually cause harm to these parties.
So your qualification is that because it's untrue, it's actionable.
Untrue and falls into, we actually pled defamation per se, so it fell into the category of you committed a crime that was untrue, you aren't qualified in your job, that was untrue.
I have no further questions.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank the attorneys for their arguments. We will take the matter under consideration and issue a ruling in due course.